Blog
hey,
Talk
everybody,
Radio.
This is Willie Windwalker, and welcome to the Willie Windwalker Show. I'm happy for you all to come by tonight and talk with me and listen to the show. I have a guest on tonight, but she hasn't showed up yet, so I'm just going to talk to you a little bit about me. I don't know people out there know exactly who I am, because there's a new breed of paranormal investigators out there and people interested in the supernatural. But I'll just give a little bit of background on me. My name is Willie Windwalker Gibson, and I'm from Louisville, Kentucky. I'm calling from Louisville, Kentucky. And I've been in the supernatural and paranormal field for, I guess, if you can count when I started at 10 years old, 55 years. And I am I'm half Cherokee and half Irish. And I'm married to my wife, Shimon, now for 32 years, and she is very involved in the paranormal and supernatural world, too, and she has gifts, and, her and me together over the years, we've done lots and lots of cases and very interesting cases, which you're going to hear about over different shows, and I'll have case studies and ghosts, of course, and demons and aliens and angels and cryptozoology. We're going to talk about Bigfoot and all kinds of good, interesting things. And I'm also going to have a few surprises. I know quite a bit of people that are in show business, movie stars and people that has TV shows and things like that. And I plan on bringing them on, too, and have a little bit of a different type of show on those nights. I plan on having for my guests in up and coming shows people you might know. I'm going to have Rich Valdez is going to come by on one show. He runs the Paranormal Clergy now, along with Kat Lang, and I'll have her on too on later shows. I'll have a young lady, Sharon Day, who is, I guess you would call, an adventurous cryptozoologist and paranormal investigator. She is very big in mysteries like giants and things like that, and very big into Bigfoot. And she lives out west, and she's got a lot of stories to tell about the adventures what's happened to her in the desert. And we've been friends for quite a long time, and she's got a lot of good stories that she want to come by and talk about. Getting back to me, I guess you could say I did not choose the paranormal. The paranormal chose me. Originally, when I was 10 years old, I could hear and see spirits, but I didn't exactly know what to do. I mean, the only person that I could talk to was my father, and he was on the Native American side, and the Irish side was my mom's side. So I had the Celtic side going on too. Mom had a little bit of gifts with her, but she never did use them much. But she understands what was going on and what was going on with me. And I had a mother and father that was very supportive. But they told me not to tell anybody else, because way back when in the early, late 50s, early 60s, you really didn't want to talk much about ghosts. And there was no such thing as paranormal investigating back then. It was like, I come from hill folk, and hill folk didn't talk too much about haints or ghosts. But as I started to have my gifts develop back when I was 10 years old, I didn't know exactly what to do with them. And as things would happen, as like ghosts would appear and I would hear things, and I had no choice but to tell my dad about them. And he looked at me and he said, I believe you, son. He said, there's some things you got to understand. And the way he trained me might have been a little bit strange to everybody out there. what he would do so that I wouldn't be afraid of death. He would take me to funeral homes. And everybody might out there might think that's kind of ghoulish, but he would take me to funeral homes, and we would go into the funeral homes of people that we knew, like in the neighborhood, like the butcher would died, and you know, the grocer died, and the neighbors would die, and sure enough, I would be taken to the funeral home to pay respects, and we would walk up to the coffin, and he would tell me, you know, son, nothing to be scared of, you know, this is just a container, and the soul is not there anymore. Well, sometimes when I would do this with him, I would look around in the room, and I would see the person standing there. They would be in the coffin, but I would see them standing over in the corner. And every now and then, you know, I would nudge my dad and point. He said, "Don't point, son." I said, "Look." He said, I know they're standing there. I see them." I said, "Well, what do we do?" He said, "There are certain things that has to happen before some people rest. You know, a lot of people hang around until they're put in sanctified ground until they go to the, you know, the funeral. And sometimes, you know, they might not want to go, and they hang around for a reason." So my dad would tell me these things. And I didn't know at the time that these were factual things he was telling me, because I didn't learn a whole lot about the paranormal until later on in life. So I had to learn how to cope with this stuff on a day-to-day basis. And so, you know, every time a ghost would show up and I would tell Dad about it, he would tell me, "Now, son, you know, you need to just ask them what they want. And if they don't tell you what they want, just tell them to move on to the light." And I would do that. And sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, you know. And what I didn't know at the time about having a spiritual light about me, you know, the aura that's around me, I had a tendency to have things show up, or I was a beacon for them. So I would have ghosts show up a lot. And lo and behold, you know, when I was 10 years old, not only did ghosts show up, but, you know, I was out, you know, in my backyard one afternoon, and looked up in the sky and saw the star. And as I watched it get bigger and bigger, it turned into a round metallic thing with lights underneath of it. There was a flash of light. Next thing I know, you know, it's dark, and I had no idea what happened. You know, I went into the house. My dad told me I hadn't been in the yard for hours, and I didn't know what to tell him. Well, at that time, I had no idea that I had been abducted by a UFO. So, you know, I had to deal with that, too. So everything started happening to me when I was 10 years old. So I guess that's when I began my journey. But, you know, I had to kind of, you know, tiptoe my way around things when I was younger. And every time a ghost would show up or something would happen, I'd go tell my dad about it. He'd explain to me what was going on. So I decided, I don't know, about when I was like 12, 13 years old, that I was going to kind of block it off a little bit as much as I could. So I got to a point where I could kind of hold everything back and keep everything at bay so I could have kind of like a normal childhood and teenage years, which I did. You know, I had my problems growing up, you know, with physical problems and things like that until I got in my early 20s. And it was that time I decided I would like to be a cop. So I went on ahead and went through police training and all that, and, you know, got sworn in and got put on a police force, a peace officer out at the Fairgrounds Police Force. So I, you know, got a night shift there and began, you know, my journey as a police officer. Now, I guess I was about, 2 months in, and it was a rainy night, and, you know, it was kind of misty out, and and it was about 2 o'clock in the morning, and I was sitting in a Native American burial ground that was on the side of the fairgrounds, and I, you know, happened to see this figure come walking out of the rain towards my car. So I jumped out of my police car, and of course I challenged them. They kept walking towards me, and of course I took my police stance, put my hand on my gun, and I had my lights on and everything. And as this person started walking further towards me into the light, I could see it was an Indian. And I said, "Hold it right there. What are you doing here?" And he smiled at me and looked me up and down and said, "I belong here." And he didn't say "I belong here" with talking out of his mouth. I knew what he was saying, I guess telepathically. And I yelled out, I said, "What is your name?" And he smiled at me. I said, "What is your name?" And the name Singing Fox came to me, and the thought came to me, "You're Indian, are you not?" And I yelled at him, "So what? Yes, I am." He said, "What is your Indian name?" You know, in my head. And I said, "I don't have one." He said, "From this day forward, your name is Windwalker." And when he said that, he kind of just faded out, you know, like he would turn off a light switch. And I just stood there, and I looked, and I didn't know what to say. So I went back to my patrol car, and I got into the patrol car, and I sat there, and I thought about it, and I thought, nah, I don't need to make a report about this. So I didn't do anything about it. So the next night, I'm sitting in the Native American burial grounds. Lo and behold, this figure shows up again. I get out of the car and walk up to him. He looks me up and down. And the thought came to my head, "Windwalker, he called a spiritual leader." At the time, I didn't know that meant shaman. "You'll be a spiritual leader, and you will help people all over the lands." And I shook my head no to him. I said, "No, I'm a police officer, and I'm going to stay a police officer." And he shook his head no. And when he did that, he disappeared. So I go back to my car, get back in the car again, and I waited till daybreak, and I was wondering what I was going to do. You know, should I tell the commander what's been going on, or should I keep quiet? Well, I decided to keep quiet because I wanted to keep my job. You don't want to have the stigma of being kind of crazy and carrying a gun, driving a police car around. So I never did say anything to him. So as night after night, as I was on patrol, you know, this Indian would show up. And, you know, we would talk. We would sit under a tree in the Native American burial grounds, and we would talk back and forth. And he would tell me things and show me things, and things started to make sense to me. You know, like, you know, how to cope with different types of entities and ceremonial things and things of that nature. So I listened to everything he said. So one day I was out in the police car, and I was on patrol, and my partner was on the other side of the cemetery. They were doing a police walk. We call it a police walk, where they get out of the car and do a around the area on foot. And it was, you know, basically you never did run into anything. But this one particular time, I was in the car, and I was in the burial grounds, and I seen this guy messing around in the burial grounds, you know, kicking things around and everything. I got out, and I challenged him, and he took off running. So I took off running after him, and he turned around, and he went to pull something out of his pants, you know, out of his belt, and I thought it was a gun. So I drew my gun, and he started running some more, and then I seen him jump over this log type of thing in the woods. And when I jumped over the log, I went straight down into, I guess it was an open pit, some kind of open pit, and I found out later it was a used to be a restroom, you know, outdoor toilet, and I had fell into the hole that, you know, and it was like being in quicksand. I mean, I was up to my belly, and I guess you call it poop, you know, and I was sinking, and I had my radio with me, and I radioed my partner, you know, I was in trouble, you know, to try to come find me, and they said they would just keep squelching the radio, and they would try to run down my location, because I had no idea where I was out in them woods, and I kept sinking and sinking, and finally I thought I was going to die, and I happened to look up, and there was this Indian, this singing fox Indian, and he reached down and grabbed a hold of my hand, and he held it, and he was solid, you know. You know, it's not your typical spirit you would look through. But, you know, he held my hand. He said, "I have you, my brother." And about that time, I could hear my partner started hollering. And I screamed out, "Hey, you know, I'm in trouble. Get over here." And as my partner approached where I was at, Singing Fox disappeared. And finally, my partner appeared. What's going on, Lieutenant? Because I had the rank of lieutenant then. What's going on, Lieutenant? And I said, "You need to get me out of here. Get a rope. Get me out of here." So they you know, "Where's the car?" And I told them where the car was. They ran back, got the car, brought it as close as they could to the hole. Luckily, we had rope in the back of the car. We had emergency equipment back there because we were kind of in a, I guess you would call it a park. So we carried emergency equipment in the car. So he pulled the rope out, threw the rope to me, tied it around the bumper of the car, and pulled me out of the hole. When he pulled me out of the hole, Ed, the guy said, "You know what, Lieutenant?" I said, "What?" He said, "You ain't going to believe this." I said, "What?" He said, "Look in the back of the cruiser." And I got up and looked in the back of the cruiser. There was the guy that I was chasing. I said, "Where did you run into him at?" He said, "Sir, you wouldn't believe it. I was doing my walk, and he come running up to me saying, 'Indians, Indians, Indians.'" And it was about that time I heard you call for help, and something told me to cuff him and bring him with me. So I just brought him with me, and I threw him in the back of the car. When I got to the cruiser, I had him secured by a tree, and I just went on ahead and put him in the cruiser when I came and got you. So he says, "I don't know what he meant by Indians, Indians." Well, I kind of figured it might have been, you know, Singing Fox kind of slowing him up a little bit so my partner can catch up with him. So it was that particular time I said to myself, maybe there's something to this. Maybe I need to look into being a shaman. And about 2 months later, you know, things started coming to me. Other spirits, Singing Fox kept coming back to me. You're going to be in the spiritual world, and you're going to do this. So I just decided to quit. I quit my job as a cop, and after that, I just went into the private sector where I can do more, and I wouldn't have to answer to anybody. So I just became a private detective, and as I did different cases, I would go out and I would also do training with other spiritual people, other shamans. And it took me years and years to learn, you know, how to be a shaman and how to act and how to do things. And I guess it took me a good 10 years before I decided to go full court press on being a shaman. And it was about that time that I met Shaman, and she was telling me she was having problems at her apartment with a spirit, and wanted to know if I could come over and check it out. So I went over to her apartment. Lo and behold, she had a lot of different things going on. She had a person that had died in the apartment that wasn't really all that bad of a person. She just didn't want to leave. And somehow she attracted a demonic force that was really nasty. I mean, this thing would leave dead flowers on her doorstep. It would mess with her when she would try to sleep. So she asked me if I could do anything, and I actually went and got a friend of mine, and we did ceremony in the apartment to draw this thing out. And let me tell you, you know, people out there don't realize when you take on something like this.
Willie.
Yes. Yes.
Your guest is here.
Okay. Well, enough about me. My guest, I've got a treat for you guys tonight. My guest is Kristen Lee. Now, anybody in the paranormal world knows that Kristen Lee is the proprietor of the Bel Air House. And if you know about the Bel Air House, you know I've got a good guest on tonight. Hey, Kristen, you there?
Yes, I'm here. Hi, everybody.
Yes. Now, I met Kristen, Shimon and me met Kristen about 5 years ago at the Mid-South Paranormal Conference here in Louisville, Kentucky. And she's a very nice person. She was, Kristen, you were very nice to Shimon, and Shimon still has the stone that you give her.
Aw, that's so cool.
Yes.
That is so cool.
Oh yeah, yeah. She's got it on her altar, and like I said, Kristen is the proprietress and the founder of the Bel Air House. Now, Kristen, you know I've been in this field a long time. I've had several shows. I've had a TV show and all that, and I've been on so long that I have got a whole new bunch of listeners, new, you know, people that are in the field. And would you tell the people out there exactly what the Bel Air House is?
Sure, yeah, absolutely. The Bel Air House is an afterlife research center. It's in Bel Air, Ohio. The address is 1699 Belmont Street, Bel Air. Our website is belairhousetours.com. But the Bel Air House, I could talk to you for years about what the Bel Air House is, but it is a place where paranormal investigators, the paranormal community, and then just paranormal enthusiasts come to spend time in the house. Like they can actually live in the house and collect data and do paranormal research investigations.
Now, Kristen, you actually lived there, didn't you?
I did, yes. I bought the house many, many, many years ago. And we left the house due to paranormal activity. I tried to walk away from the house a few times and was unable to do that. Then there was actually a time where I had to fight to keep the house. So, I mean, it's been an up and down, more of a balance than anything with the Bel Air House. But currently right now I have been researching the house itself. I've been researching how like psychology intertwines with the supernatural, how it affects us physiological, how it affects our actual body, all of that together, and the afterlife process too of communication and how energy transforms and how it can actually make communication with us, the mechanics behind it, so to speak. But that's what I've been doing for, well, since 2015, really dove into that part of life in the supernatural. But, you know, I have been susceptible to paranormal quite longer than that, as well as, like, the medicinal parts of things when it comes to nature and balancing. Just the whole spirituality. I've always been drawn to a lot of different metaphysics.
Well, Kristen, before you moved into the house, were you into the paranormal or did living in the house change you?
It did change, yes. It did change my perspective. It did change it. I was scared in the beginning. I'll tell you, I wasn't schooled with paranormal equipment. I never had really encountered a negative energy or a negative entity, not to that degree, like the Bel Air House. I experienced it at the Bel Air House. So I was trained by many members of the paranormal community and also the Stregerian community on how to you know, do protection and how to approach those types of energies. But yeah, nothing like as a child that was malicious like that, nothing as an early adult, but you know, later in in life. Yes, it and I'll tell you, some of that energy, that negative force, it is still at the Belair House. Sometimes it comes out, sometimes it doesn't. We like to hope that it doesn't, because we really want to learn the communication process from, you know, from spirit. That's what our major focus is now. We know that there's something negative there. We've had, like your guest last week, I believe it was James Long. He has been there before, and he has given me quite a few lessons on how to operate and deal with things. And, you know, it's just, it comes to a time where anybody in the field, they can either focus on inhuman, demonic all day long, or they can try to balance it the best that they can so they can have a more of a stable life. Because you want to talk to positive spirits too. You want to talk to earthbound spirits. You want to talk to cranky spirits, just not solely focus on one particular type of energy. That's draining. You know, for me at least, that is very draining.
Well, Kristen, do you think that the house has actually attached itself to you?
Probably. and the reason why I say probably is because I don't know if I will ever have that answer. But with some things that I have learned along the way, and, you know, just being paying attention to how energy circulates, how it works, how it manifests, residual energy, learning about that. And also, too, I can't discount the psychological energy that can manifest to actually turn into, you know, what we think is what we believe. What we believe is what we do. Our actions cause, or our thoughts cause our actions, which causes our behaviors. Like the psychological part of it, yeah, that's, I'm sure that's there too. So it's, I can't definitively say, yes, it's 100% attached itself to me from the supernatural realm, because that would be irresponsible. I believe that there's also that psychological part of it too, which can manifest.
Well, I know I'm friends with Carmen Reed, and also Prine, Miss Prine, and they seem, you know, they had their own adventures in their houses too. And has it affected your, you know, your family? I mean, has it brought any kind of gifts out of your family, or has it made your family, you know, I don't know, more intense? I mean, did it affect your family at all?
Oh, it certainly did affect the family in the beginning. There was a long period of time where things were just very gloomy and grim, but we were very resilient as a family, and we pushed through that. But, you know, if we take into consideration that, you know, our family dynamics, we're super intense people anyway. We truly are. So things can be intensified. They can be intensified, I should say. You know, but I don't feel like, sometimes I question, okay, was anybody sloppy this week? When we came home from the Belair House, did we all do, you know, the things that we need to do because of the energy inside the house? Sometimes, you know, if things kind of get a little touchy, I'll ask questions, but we're all pretty good at doing our rituals to make sure that there's nothing that can physically harm us. Does that make sense?
Yes. Now, do you go back and forth to the house? I mean, you don't live there anymore. I mean, how far do you live from there?
I'm not too far. I'm maybe 10, 15 minutes from the house. But no, I do not live there anymore. And there are days, you know, and there are times where I'm like, man, that would be so cool to have that home. I mean, because it was the perfect house. It truly was. It was spacious. It's large. It's beautiful. The things that could have been done to it. I do grieve over that loss a lot, not being able to live there. But, you know, I've been blessed with another beautiful place. It isn't as beautiful as the Belair House or what I envisioned the Belair House to be, and it'll never be that. But it accommodates my needs right now.
Now, by living in the Belair House and piquing your interest in other things, I noticed by your bio, you've got spiritual advisor down here. Do you do readings?
I do. I've been a spiritual advisor professionally on an international level since 2014, November of 2014 is when I began that spiritual journey. It's been such a blessing. I get to stay home and take calls, and, you know, the switchboard operators keep them coming. So I have been very blessed with that. But, you know, going back to that whole, like, intuitive psychic medium, mysticism, prediction, like, all of that, it's there. I think it's there in all of us. I do. But I also feel like different experiences that we have in life can definitely make us even more spiritual, make us even more in tune, or as some people would say, level up to enlightenment. And it's I like it. I like the lifestyle. It accommodates. Again, I've been very, very blessed.
Oh, also, you're into astrology too.
I love it. Yes, I love astrology. I love the planets. I love the constellations. I love different types of, like the old witch's timepiece, planetary alignment timepiece, and it goes into hours of days and like days, certain days and certain hours of each day has higher metaphysical peaks of manifestation. I love that. I love solar energy and lunar energy. I love planets. I'm out there when it comes to like the universe and stuff like that. I think it's just super cool. And I've always thought that was cool.
Another thing I got on your biography, forensic psychologist. Now, what exactly is that?
Well, a forensic psychologist is someone that would be considered like a forensic mental health professional. And typically what they do is they do some evaluations, different types of psychological evaluations on various topics, very special topic populations, special populations. Some of them, it's a wide range. But in what I did was I did competency and incompetency hearings for people, did the evaluations for them. To prove incompetency or competent when they stood trial. Some of them were had committed major crimes. Some of them did not. But it just at that point in time of their life, what was going on in their home, what was going on in their life, their surroundings, their environment, and would it have triggered them? What was going on in their medication, their whole medical, you know, history? Is there anything that, and psychological history, was there anything that could have been a trigger to make them do what they did? So basically, it was either put, you know, what the report says is they go to jail or they go to a mental institution. So it was tough. It was a tough gig.
Have you ever run across a case that was you were brought into that was supernatural and you didn't know exactly how to handle that?
Oh my God, yes, absolutely, 100%. When I was in undergrad, I worked on a crisis unit in West Virginia, and there was a lady who was on the crisis unit that was saying to me that demons were trying to get her. And at this time, I didn't believe in demons. I just didn't. I never had an experience with inhuman, demonic. It never was there in my life. So being that trained mental health professional, I assumed, as a mental health professional should, that she was having auditory and visual hallucinations. So at that point in time, I tried to help her the best that I could, and I took her into the activities room and tried to calm her, and she kept pointing, the demons are coming, it's right there, can't you see it? And because I was not believing her, I wasn't open to seeing that. And the silliest thing that I did was I put on the TV for her to calm down when I went to get her something to drink. But I put on the Catholic station where people were reciting the rosary. And I learned later in life is if there is something demonic or inhuman, the last thing that you want to do is say Glory Be, Hail Mary, you know, any of that, because you're going to trigger it. But at that time, and this was, gosh, I was in my early 20s, I didn't get that. I didn't understand that like I do today. So, yeah, you know, and then shortly after that whole experience, I went on to a different program. I went on actually to my master's program, which got me out of that crisis unit. After I almost completed the master's program, I went to a different location that was still in the same area, and I accepted the job. And as I walked out from accepting the job, there was the same client that I had that experience with in when I was an undergrad. And I this is one thing that I will probably regret but forever, but I called them back and I said, listen, the job's just not going to work out, because I didn't want to deal with that. I just wasn't ready to deal with, I can deal with audio auditory and visual hallucinations, but not when a client or patient is screaming demon. I wasn't equipped to do anything like that, not as a mental health professional, but as somebody that researches the paranormal. And I always look back on that because of it.
Now, this was before Bel Air House, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. But let me tell you this. When I took the job, that job, and saw her the second time, I was living in the Bel Air House. And I remember clearly calling the lady in Wheeling, and I was using the Bel Air House phone in the hallway, from the hallway to the kitchen to the basement. That's where I was standing. And I told her that, thank you very much for the opportunity, but I'm going to decline at this time, and good luck. Yeah. I remember clearly that second time that I met that lady, just not taking that job. And that was in the Blair House. The first time was not.
Okay, Kristen, how do you, as a trained psychologist, how do you go into a place like the Blair House and live there, and how do you separate the supernatural from the mental?
Well, the thing of it is, it's hard. It's hard to do that. It truly is. And I think that a good word that we all use is debunking. Like, we're debunking it. We're debunking this. We're debunking that. And I think that that's a good way to look at it, too, not just from the supernatural standpoint, but also from the psychological standpoint. You know, I've watched guests to the Bel Air House, and I've seen some things that they truly believe that it's paranormal, but how could it be? Of course, I don't like say I don't think that that's it. I don't want to, I don't want to upset them or anything, but there's some things that do occur that are really, truly, you cannot explain them. There's no reason, there's no rhyme, there's nothing. But then there are other times where somebody might be affected more psychologically than anything and freaking themselves out, like being the other term that we use in paranormal, suggestive, So you have to kind of look at the suggestive part of it and like the debunking part of it, I guess, at the same time.
Well, you living in Blair House, I mean, and being a psychologist, you really didn't have really any place else to go. I mean, did you have to figure that out for yourself, or did you have some help come in to explain things?
I did. I both. I left the house before the explanation came. About 2 weeks after I left the Bel Air House and we were settled and I knew that we were safe, that's when I started to get very inquisitive. I was mad. Like, I was super angry that there's something in that house and it doesn't make any sense. And I am questioning everything that I have believed, from my training. So I did reach out to Mike and Amanda McAllister. They're from the Portsmouth, Ohio area. And their team was called Ohio Valley Paranormal Researchers, or Research Investigations, Ohio Valley Paranormal Research Investigations. And they worked with me for months. The house sat abandoned, and we Mike taught me the ropes on. I didn't know what a spirit box was, but back then they were called hack shacks. Him and Danny Huang and the Kentucky Ghost Scouts, and even Eyes of Paranormal, like those were all of the people that helped me right in the beginning. After a while, you know, we did close the house down. Well, we opened it up for more research with other groups. But then somebody got hurt. They were pushed in the second story window. And so we pulled the plug on that and then just tried to rent it out a few times. But people didn't, they just didn't stay long. And they all reported, you know, paranormal activity. Some of them didn't report the paranormal activity, but their lives drastically changed. It's just bad things happened. And it was so bad that some of them had to move out because they had to relocate. So, I mean, there were times where things just didn't, like, I just don't believe in coincidences anymore because of the paranormal, supernatural energies. I don't. I feel like there is more, there's just more that lines up that makes sense. When it's bad luck, lost jobs, you know, bad finances, it's actually physically seeing children, apparitions in the house, those types of things.
Kristen, have you ever checked the background of the house, the history of the house, to help you explain what was going on in there?
After, yes, a little bit in like 2012, 2013, just a tad bit, because my intentions weren't to keep the house and my intentions weren't to make the house the Belair house. That was never my intention. But after we did open up like for people to investigate it as an afterlife research center, we dove in very heavy to the research. The research is very long. We can go back to the French and Indian War, and we can go back to coal mine explosions from the coal miners. The house does sit on top of a coal mine, and it was owned by Jacob Hetherington, who basically owned all of Bel Air at his later life. We have the Ohio River in front of the house, and there's a ley line in the house. So there's a lot. There's and the history of the Hetherington family individually is it's pretty phenomenal too. There's Jacob Hetherington and the founder of Bel Air, Jacob Davis, and then a very prominent boat captain, Captain Fink. They were all abolitionists, and the Belair House was definitely used for runaway slaves. And we have found some census records where Lyde Hetherington, who was the granddaughter of Jacob Hetherington, had servants, and her brother Edwin lived there with her. He turns out he was a medium, a seer is what they called him, and he had people from all over the world come to connect him to Lyde, who ended up dying in the house. So when he learned that Lyde was, when she had transitioned to spirit, he wanted to still be able to communicate with her. So then he dove into spiritualism himself, and their father, Alex, he was committed to a lunatic asylum. There's a lot. There's so much of the Hetherington family.
It sounds like a lot of energy is built up in the house.
I think that it over time, yes, definitely over time. And, you know, we have some, we call them the Belair House residential spirits, like they're the residents of the house, spiritual residents, and they do like to communicate with us. Because of the ley line, we do have, you know, different spirits that come in every now and then. More recently, new ones. We're still trying to figure out why. It's almost like the Hetheringtons went on vacation for about 4 months. it's what it feels like. And they come back every now and then to talk. But there has been some new spirits in the house that a lot of teams have reported. And I think that's interesting because, you know, it's just not people that had an attachment to the land. It could be the ley line. It could be just the energy that the house puts off that attracts spirits to it because they know it's a communication device. They can gain energy perhaps. Maybe it kind of replenishes them and fills up their cup. I don't know. That's something that we're looking at.
I've seen quite a few television shows, paranormal television shows with the Belair House on. I've seen you on a couple of them, you know, giving information. Do they embellish it too much for your liking, or do they pretty much stick to the truth?
Well, I think that they stick to the truth for the most part, but everything on TV has to be sensationalized. That's just the way TV is. So, you know, they've the past couple of shows that I've done, they've let me kind of have control on how I want to tell my story, because I like to keep it as real as possible and not, I don't want to cry. And I always tell them that if you say anything that's going to trigger me to cry, I won't talk about it, because I don't want to show like a baby crying on TV. You know, I don't want to be emotional like that. I'd rather be more in telling the recent data. But it's not what they look for. They don't look for data. They want horrific stories. They want that. That's truly what my experience was. Now, there was one show that came in, and it was Most Terrifying Places, and I really liked that production. I truly liked the fact that they let me talk as the owner of the home, not the person that was, you know, affected by the home, because that's changed. I mean, yes, I was affected by it, but I've grown so much since then, and I know so much more now. And I don't, it's almost like if you have to listen to the same song over and over and over again, or if you're a musician and you're like, I don't know, the Beatles, and you got to get out every night and play the same song over and over again. Nobody wants to do that, you know?
Yeah, well, the episode I saw, I think A&E did it, and it made it look like your regular haunted house type of thing, and you were getting attacked, and your son was getting attacked, and all this. And I said, next time I talk to Kristen, I'm going to have to get this straight, because I think they're kind of, you know, embellishing this a little bit.
Well, we were definitely attacked, yes. There was physiological harm, yes. But that was, gosh, that was like 2008, 2009, you know, and here we are in 2020. Let's talk about what we've discovered. You know, that's really where I want to go. And that's probably
yeah.
why I don't do a lot of these shows, because, and I don't do a lot of them, but the ones that I do, I really enjoy. But I don't want to do this whole spooktacular thing. Let's get to the real meat and potatoes on what is out there and educate humanity. That's where I am in my mind. So sometimes we butt heads with TV.
Well, you can look at it this way, Kristen. It kind of sounds like the house kind of educated you a lot.
Absolutely. Oh, my gosh, yes. Yeah, and being open to those experiences, too, is that's a big deal. You know, if you think about it, there's families all over the world that have homes that are like the Blair House. And, you know, I think it's best that any investigator that's doing residential cases, they need to investigate with the family, teach the family the ropes. If not the whole family, at least one of the family members, so they can sustain, you know. And I do recommend, if anything, if anybody's home is like the Blair House, try to find something to rent and, you know, calm down and clear your mind and try to balance. Because I don't think anybody will ever be able to live full time in that Blair House. I just don't. And I think it was the best decision I made, is just opening it up as a research, afterlife research center.
Well, I was looking also on your bio. You've got a past life regressionist. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Oh, absolutely. Thank you. I love that part. Typically, you know, I do believe in like multi dimensions and different past lives, and how our soul, you know, when we transition to spirit, we've learned lessons. You know, we've learned life lessons, and if we don't gain information to become better for a greater good in life, then we have to repeat those lessons. So I do believe in soul connections. I do believe in past lives when it comes to the soul. I believe the soul is, it can manifest new bodies, reincarnation, of course. But when I do therapeutic past life regression therapy, it's one of my favorite things to do, to be honest with you. I'm able to put the client in hypnosis and take them through a very deep hypnosis and take them through different time frames of their whole entire life. not just this lifetime, but many lifetimes. And, you know, if sometimes that there is like a death that they're struggling with seeing, and I bring them back out, but it can be very, very intense. And I just think it's one of the cooler things that I've ever studied.
I know I've done some of that, and I've done soul retrievals, and it can get pretty rough sometimes.
Yes. Yes.
When you've done that, and you've with me, it takes a lot out of me to do that. Does it do you?
In the beginning, it did. But, you know, I think it's different from being a psychic that does, you know, 10 readings a day. That's draining. That whoops me down. I have to, like, just kind of lay on the couch or go straight to bed after I'm done doing readings. But if I was doing a past life regression therapy session, maybe just one person, I could probably go cut the lawn or do something cool afterwards and have some energy. But I wouldn't go past two of them. I think doing two sessions back to back would probably make me want to go to sleep. But not just one.
Yeah, well, you know, there was one weekend at Mid-South, I did 40 readings, and I was pretty wiped.
Wow, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And I know.
It shows on here, you're an author, too. So tell us a little bit about your books.
Well, there's a new book called Paranormal Confessions. It's with Hampton Roads, which is part of Wiser Publishing and Red Will Publishing. It should be out in July of 21. I have to do the final edit on the book, like read it and see if I like everything where they rearranged everything. And I have to look at that after Halloween because we're busy at the Blair House. So in November, I'll be doing that last edit. And then we should probably start, you know, getting that ball rolling for that July time frame.
You're talking about July next year, right?
Yes, it'll be July next year. Yeah. Now, there's another book out. It's called 1699 Belmont Street, A Portal to Hell. That was the first book that I wrote. I self-published it. That's on Amazon as digital right now. There were hard copies, but, you know, we've sold out of them a lot. I just never ordered new ones because of the new book.
Now, is there anything that Kristen Lee hasn't done that she wants to do?
Yes, there's a lot that I want to do. There truly is. There's an awful lot that I want to do, and I don't feel like it has anything to do with the paranormal or being psychic or anything. I really like to do, I like to sew blankets. That's pretty cool, but that has metaphysical stuff to it. The thing that really doesn't, I really want to learn how to perfect, like, acrylic nails, like fingernails. I want to do that. I want to be able to do art on them, but it's a process, and I'm not an artist. So that's one thing that I would love to do. And then, you know, of course, travel a lot more. I would love to travel to many different places. And eventually I want to retire in a very warm climate. I don't want to live in Ohio for the rest of my life.
Now, people don't realize this. I don't know if they know you quite as well as I do in your bio, but you were a musician too, weren't you?
Yeah, I was totally a musician. It was in my formative years, my early formative years. And I'm so able to be a part of music, but it isn't my music. My son is a hip-hop artist, and that is where I'm able to kind of let those creative juices out with him. He's written a lot of really cool hip-hop songs, and some of them, you know, I'll say, why don't you move it here, or why don't you do this, or hey, why don't you tell this story? You know, so it's just like the fine tuning of a few things that he's done that he's allowed me to work with him on. And I always think that's cool because that is really cool for us to be able to have that in common. But it's really cool to work with him because he's so smart when it comes to writing music.
Well, Kristen, do you want to give any advice out there? We've got a couple of minutes. Do you want to give the people any advice out there as far as the supernatural and the paranormal?
Well, everybody needs to remember, and this is very general, but I feel like if anybody's having a difficult time or difficult decisions, or having difficulties making decisions, try to remember what your first gut feeling was, what your first thought was when the situation in life or in the paranormal or supernatural had presented itself to you. And it might take you a couple of days to remember. And then you have to make the final decision based on that first gut feeling. And from that foot forward, any first gut feeling that you ever have, you have to pay attention to it. Do not discount it.
Good. Now, give the people the information on Bel Air House again before you go.
Oh, sure. On Facebook, it's called Bel Air House Tours. I believe that's what it is. On the website, it's belairhousetours.com.
Okay, Kristen, thank you for coming by tonight, and hopefully you'll be on again soon. Again, and I want to thank you again for coming on tonight.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciated it. You have a good night.
You too.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye. Okay, folks, time is running short again tonight. Next week, hopefully, we'll be on our regular time at 7 o'clock. And like I said before, I'm going to have Rich Valdez on tomorrow, next week. He runs the Paranormal Clergy now. And we're going to talk a little bit about the Paranormal Clergy and what it's all about and how to get in touch with them and what he's doing. He is a demonologist and... you know, we'll have a good show next week. And as far as me, you can get a hold of me on Facebook, Willie Gibson. You can get a hold of me at crystalchief55@aol.com. I have two books. One is named The Shaman Windwalker. The other is The Soul Warriors. You can find those on Amazon.com. I do write for Underground Paranormal Magazine. I do a story every month for that, and I also do a story each month in Legends Magazine. That's Mary Sutherland's publication. So I'm out doing a lot of different things. I'm going to start going, you know, back doing cases for mine and me, and, of course, I do a lot of cases online. So if you need to get in touch with me about anything, just go to Facebook, Willie Gibson, and, you know, tell me what's going on, and I'll try to get you some help, okay? So this has been Willie Windwalker Gibson. This has been the Willie Windwalker Show, and I'll see you again next week. Good night.